Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. As I record this, 28 of the 30 teams have played a game. The other two will have played by the time you hear this, which means we now know who's winning the title, which teams should be blown up, and of course, the MVP. Do fans and media and other sports overreact the way we do on the NBA? Is it just an NBA thing? I kind of feel like it might be. Anyway, to help me not overreact, but maybe shed a little light on what does matter so far, is one of the smartest NBA analysts out there, my friend Seth Partnow. You know him from his work at The Athletic, his book, The Mid-Range Theory, which we discussed on the pod last year. And of course, he's formerly the director of basketball research for the Milwaukee Bucks. Super smart dude. We are going to discuss all of the sample size, theater, early impressions, and a couple other things. Before we get to Seth, my weekly plug, Sports Illustrated and Triumph Books have a great new book out commemorating the Lakers' 75th anniversary. It's called The Greatest Show on Earth. It's got 15 stories from the pages of SI from the 60s to the present, covering all the Laker legends. I'm talking Kareem and Magic and Wilt, Elgin Baylor, Kobe, Shaq, LeBron, and written by some of the greatest sports writers of those eras. Frank DeFord, Jack McCallum, Lee Jenkins, Chris Ballard, and many more. I had the honor of writing the introduction for this book, and it's now available for pre-order with a 30% discount. Here's what you do. Go to triumphbooks.com, search for Greatest Show on Earth. There's also a direct link in the summary of this podcast, or you can go to this bit.ly link, bit.ly/Lakers75. When you get to checkout, use the discount code Lakers30. Again, triumphbooks.com or the link that I just mentioned and in the summary of this podcast, discount code Lakers30. Okay, my conversation with Seth Partnow is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now pleased to be joined by the man who separates all NBA players into tiers, which are not rankings. They're just tiers, folks. But even in tiers, they are still designed to insult your favorite player and your favorite team because he's just mean that way. Seth Partnow, how are you, sir?
How's it going, Howard? Thanks for having me. I hate your team no matter who it is, and I hate them all equally.
That's the point of the tiers, really, is that no matter what tier you're in, somehow you've been insulted. You've been slighted. All tiers, all rankings are just made to insult and annoy people. That's why they exist. Also to get you to keep clicking, frankly.
You know, commerce has to commerce.
Indeed. I should note before we get too deep into this, Seth and I are in the back half of a home and home here, which means you can also hear me yammering on Seth's podcast, Callin' Shots, on the Call-In app. It's very confusing to have the Call-In Shots on the Call-In app, but it's also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the other places where you get podcasts. So go look for that as well. We talk a lot of Lakers and the season and broadly parody, some other things. It was a fun conversation. People should go check that out too. So back to your tears for a minute. We're going to get into some overreaction theater here with on day three of the NBA season. But before we do, so you've done the tears for the Athletic a few years running now. Is it year three?
This past summer was year three. Yeah.
Okay. Based solely on that and the solely unscientific gauge of social media, who are the perennial most aggrieved fan bases, either by city or player? Who is screaming at you the most about why you have been mean to their team or player?
I mean it's consistently been Knicks fans. There's a player type that I am upfront that I am, you know, I think less of than probably consensus, which is the sort of high volume, moderate to slightly below average efficiency score on a mediocre team, like the star player on a bad team kind of guy. So I like, you know, over the years, it's been, you know, RJ Barrett, Brendan Ingram, players of that sort of kind of archetype that people think that I'm more down on relative to kind of high level role players. Like, you know, I gravitate more towards the Mikal Bridges, the Dorian Finney-Smith, just because I'm like, for those guys, you know, if you're RJ Barrett and you're trying to win a championship, RJ Barrett is matching up with, you know, just in terms of not necessarily like who's guarding whom, but in terms of like stature on a team, he's matching up with Paul George. He's matching up with, you know, or go up the ladder, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Kawhi, like, you're at a disadvantage. Whereas if you have those elite 3-and-D guys, which is, you know, it's your Mikal Bridges, Dorian Finney-Smith, Andrew Wiggins, which is why he's become such a valuable player in Golden State, those players fit in anywhere and contribute positively anywhere. Now, if you don't have, you know, that's is that the side dish and you need the sizzle, the main course, the star player? Yeah, but that's why you need a tier one, tier two player to really compete for a title.
Yeah. It's funny, and I think you and I actually had this conversation at one point, but just the idea of like trying to calibrate how to rate somebody when, you know, having a primary scorer is really important. And so RJ Barrett's going to be the next primary scorer, possibly, presumably, he and Randall. But if they're not efficient, then like you're not great in the role. The role is we need you to kind of be the star that you maybe not are suited for, whereas you're saying, you know, you're giving a higher ranking essentially or a higher value in your mind to the Mikal Bridges type, because though it's a lesser role, he's playing it to the hilt. He is the among the best of the best within that that framework, which really matters, right? NBA teams, ultimately, you're trying to kind of slot guys into roles, and it's when guys have to play a role that's bigger than they can handle. If you try to make Mikal Bridges the fulcrum of your offense, suddenly you, Seth Partnow, are probably dropping him a tier or two.
This was really, this is a lesson that I learned hard the first time, I think, with Trevor Ariza. When he went from the Lakers, and I have it right, they went from the Lakers to the Rockets, right?
I think that's right.
As a big free agent signing, and he'd been like kind of a revelation as that, you know, play good defense, stick a corner three, get out in transition.
Former Knicks draft pick Trevor Ariza, yeah. I might note.
Right, and he'd emerged in the postseason of that, and then he goes to the Rockets and is expected to be a ball in hands guy, and was pretty poor. And it's just like, well, he's not a worse player. He's just like, in one situation, he's asked to do the things he can do, and the other, he's asked to do things he can't do. And and it's the same player, but in one situation, he's, I mean, demonstrably very useful towards winning a title. And in the other, he's an anchor.
Yeah. Yeah. And I look, I mean, listen, you worked for the Bucks for a few years, and people around the league, whether we're analyzing from the outside or from the inside, that is the key, right? It is finding not just the best players. You need a lot of the best players to win at a high level, but it's finding the right players and the right fit, and also then putting them in a system or a program or next to players where you get the best out of them, but don't ask them to do too much or be more of a contributor than they're designed to be or than they're capable of being, right? Like it's none of it's that simple, but it kind of breaks down that way. So, and I think that's what fans sometimes lose track of, and also getting caught up in the numbers. And obviously, you know, a guy like Barrett, don't want to pick on him necessarily, but he's a guy who has put up some numbers, and especially last season, you start running him through Basketball Reference and you go, oh, he charts out as this. He's in this elite group of guys who have done this by X age or whatever. But if it's not at an efficient rate and you can't see the efficiency coming based on his jump shot or whatever, that all matters too, right? So
it's ultimately a team game, and it's if I score 50 but we total 52, if we scored 52 total, have I had a good game or not?
Yeah.
If you're playing fantasy, obviously, if you're trying to win NBA basketball games, maybe not.
Yeah. Well, I used to say this about sometimes a team would be on a streak of allowing a bunch of players to go for 30 or 40 on them or something, or like three guys got 40 on them in a week or something. It really doesn't matter. Like if a guy goes for 70 on you, that's a big gaudy number. Not that many players have gone for 70 in NBA history, but like we get caught up in somebody getting a 50 piece. It really doesn't matter if the rest of the team didn't do anything, right? And if you won, and if you still scored one more point than the team with the 50 point guy. So we sometimes get a little bit too caught up. And now granted, most of the time a guy gets 50 plus, it's probably because he was scoring at a pretty high efficiency that game, which is why he kept getting opportunities from his teammates and his coach to keep going. So anyway,
no, it's hard to have a bad game, but it's just, there's gradations of good.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I had a note in my notes from a year ago when we spoke, your wonderful book first came out, which is now in paperback, correct? The Mid-Range Theory
came out this week in paperback.
So we talked about it a year ago on the pod when it had first come out. It is now in paperback. So folks, if you didn't get it the first time, go buy it now. I had in my notes from a year ago that I did not get to, I don't think, and I wanted to ask you now because I've never asked you. You were with the Bucks for that big chunk of time. Did you get a ring when they won?
I had left by the time that they won. My equivalent of it is as someone I knew at the NBA actually took a copy of my book and put it on the pedestal with the Larry O'Brien trophy and took a picture of that and sent it to me. And honestly, that's my avatar on Twitter now. And so I think that was, I don't want to say it's just as good, but I got a lot of satisfaction from that.
Yeah. The time, everything, first of all, the last few years, like time has had no meaning. And so I keep having a hard time trying to remember order of events, but I thought you were still there, like at least earlier in that season or something. Did I misremember that as
no,
well?
I left the 2019 off season. So my first year back in public was the season that got delayed via the pandemic. So, I think I would feel probably a lot more conflicted about the Bucks having won the title if they had ended up winning the title that year. Like, you never, if there being 2 years space between when I left and when it's like, I didn't want to, replace the Ewing theory with the Partnow theory. I didn't want that to happen.
Fair enough. All right. So I wanted to bring you on for a couple reasons, but not least of which is that, we're taping this on a Thursday, a couple hours before the game. So 28 teams have played a single game each, and two teams have not played yet. That's the Clippers and your former employer, the Milwaukee Bucks. And you had already gotten to having some fun with some small sample size theater, but with all the qualifiers that it's a person of your intellectual sophistication would have, which is, hey, folks, I don't want to go too far with this, but interesting to note that XYZ has happened. And I thought, but this is first week of the NBA season, and this is what we do, right? We're already ready to bury the Nets. They were a disaster against the Pelicans. We're ready to bury the Lakers. We were already ready to bury the Lakers anyway. We're just looking for the proof. Jalen Duren is now in Rookie of the Year consideration, apparently. So I just thought it'd be fun to do a little bit of small sample size theater here. And before I get to kind of like the few of the ones that you have noticed that are interesting beyond just being a one-game sample. I thought I'd just throw a few of these at you because they are ridiculous on their face, but maybe not entirely ridiculous. So who should be more worried, Seth, the Lakers or the Nets?
The Lakers. You can see a path for the Nets. Now, I should caveat that by saying that if they trade Westbrook and picks for Miles Turner and Buddy Hield, then I guess that's a pretty sharp sea change for the Lakers as well. But barring that, like with the rosters they currently have, the Nets played bad, the Lakers are bad, and I think one of those is an easier fix.
So let me just pull on one thread there, which is this. Rob Pelinka, before the season began, the Lakers team president, GM, whatever his title is these days, who has an extension, said he's not opposed to trading the two first-round picks that they have available to them if it's the right move. And I think he alluded to the idea that it should make them a contender. Or maybe that's been reporting that it's they only want to do if it makes them a contender. I don't think there's anything they can do in the short term that's going to make them a contender. But I do think that the trade that you've talked about, that everybody has speculated on for a long time now, that's been discussed between the teams, the Hield-Turner thing, it doesn't make them a title contender, Seth, but I believe it at least makes them much better and relevant and solves certain, or at least fills certain gaps in that roster. Like, if you were working for the Lakers right now in the position that you had with the Bucks, and they came to you and said, what do you think? Is this good enough return? Does it get us far enough, advance us enough this season? We don't need to be contenders. Let's just say the Lakers actually conceded that point. We just want to be in the mix. We want to be a top six team. We want to have a puncher's chance to advance in the playoffs. Is that deal worth it?
I mean, so the first thing I ask is how long is my contract insofar as what's the chances that I'm around when those draft picks come due?
You got an extension when Pelinka did. How about that?
Well, no, but if I'm somewhere else when those picks come due, let's fire away. Like that's costless for me. But in all seriousness, I think with that trade, it at least puts them in chip in a chair territory. In that does it make them prime contenders? No. Does it put them in a situation where, hey, if we get a reasonably balanced roster to the playoffs and have LeBron and Anthony Davis healthy, does anyone want to play us? So then, like, would I pick them to beat the Warriors in the series? No. Would I pick them to beat the Clippers? Well, I mean, seven home games, so maybe. But but at least it's best player on the floor still means something, and can LeBron dial up for if he again doesn't have to use all his energy during the regular season to get them to the seventh seed? I've talked about this a lot, as I wrote the first "Is LeBron Slowing Down" article in 2014. Oops.
8 years ago.
Yeah, eight Holy years crap. Ago. So, I'm a little wow. gun shy, but even with those concerns, like, do you want to play LeBron with a real team around him in the playoffs?
Yeah. I've been saying this each of the last few years because his seasons keep getting short because of injury. And that's what happens when you get older in this league and when you've logged as many miles as he has in this league. But the fact is, when he does play, he's still playing at an MVP level. He's putting up MVP kind of numbers. You can knock him on the defensive side if you want to. But in a playoff series, if he's well rested, when I know he'll turn up the defense, I'm still rolling with him. In fact, I know we're all, everybody's moved on to Giannis is best player in the league, or it's Jokic, or maybe it's Embiid, or it's going to be Luka soon, or hey, on any given night, it's Durant. On any given night in any given playoff series, I'd still say it's possibly LeBron. For 82 games, it may not be. But if you gave me one guy I could pick for a playoff series tomorrow, best of seven, I think I'm still taking LeBron personally. But, I don't think it's that big of a stretch.
Yeah. No, I think honestly, like, LeBron is the bigger half of that deal is, frankly, the single biggest issue with the Lakers is that if Anthony Davis was a guy who could play 2,800 minutes a year, play 75, 80 games, 2,800 minutes, and just, like, be that guy, then their floor can only go so low.
but he's not that. And so just getting like a Miles Turner to be able to, all right, well, you don't need to make every play on defense for us. You can if you play, there's a couple nights a year where you play defense, you only play hard on defense for 10 minutes. That's fine. Just being able to do that puts them in a situation where just getting to April reasonably whole would be is something that, you know, is just going to be hard for them on regardless of what their record is by that point.
Yeah. Listen, I understand the idea that, you know, maybe as teams start figuring out who they are and who they aren't over the next month, that some teams will start pulling the plug, try to jump into the Wembanyama sweepstakes perhaps, and that other trades might become available that maybe are a better payoff than Hield and Turner. But if that was the only deal I could get, I would absolutely do it myself. Of course, slight caveat there too. Miles Turner twisted his ankle last night, and he's been hurt a lot over the course of his career. But when healthy, and I feel like that would be an unfortunate thing with the Lakers. It's like Anthony Davis when healthy, LeBron when healthy, Miles Turner when healthy. When healthy, guy's an incredible shot blocker and can shoot the three much better than Anthony Davis does. So now you've got ability to space the floor with two bigs out there. I would do it. Easy for me to say,
right?
But I would do it.
Let me suggest, last point on this, that Indiana is going to be very conservative in terms of their players coming back from injury this year. I feel pretty confident that no one is rushing Miles Turner to get back on the floor in sort of the Pacers organization right now.
All right, second question, for whatever reason, small sample size theater, and I alluded to this in the opener. All right, who's leading the Rookie of the Year campaign? Rookie of the Year, Paolo Banchero or Jalen Duren? Banchero's first game, 27 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists, and 2 blocks. Jalen Duren, the 13th pick, going to the Pistons through machinations that involved the Knicks. 14-10 with 3 blocks. A lot of Jalen Duren excitement on the timeline last night. Who you got, Banchero or Duren, in small sample size theater for Rookie of the Year?
Wrong Piston. Give me Jaden
Ivey.
Yeah. No, I think
Duren was the more fun one to throw in there, but obviously, Ivey had a pretty nice debut as well.
I mean, you know, Banchero is going to, he's going to play enough. He's going to have the ball enough. He's going to put up the numbers, and he's frankly pretty good. I mean, it's like, you know, single game, but if that's at all like the Paolo Banchero we see this season, it's an award that's done by January.
It's interesting, and part of the reason I brought it up, Seth, is that not everybody around the league was sold, right? Like, you had this kind of three-man race for the number one pick, and, you know, I think some people felt like, well, Banchero, he's going to be really solid. He's going to do a lot of things really well, but maybe not one thing elite, right? And so it was, is he really a building block? Is he really the primary building block, right? And so that he came out blazing, again, one game against not so great opponent, but that he came out blazing, I think was interesting to see, just because I felt like there was some modest expectations by teams that were not Orlando, by teams that were not as high on him as worthy of number one, with the idea that this is a guy who now is your foundation. But again, one game.
I think there's probably a pretty strong consensus that of the three players, Jabari Smith, Chet Holmgren, and Banchero, of the three, he was going to have the best rookie season, just from a skill set, physicality standpoint. Like, he's just more ready to do stuff. Like, Holmgren, obviously, you know, he's missing the season, but all just like the physicality, and you know, Jabari Smith is a lot of his potential is defensive, and it's not going to matter with Houston this year because they're not going to be good defensively no matter what they do. So it's looking a couple years down the road to him being sort of almost like the what if Michael Porter Jr. could guard, kind of is almost like the idealized version of Jabari Smith, and that's a very good player, but that's, you know, that's not something that's rookies are bad defensively just in general. I mean, give or take Evan Mobley. Yeah. So we just weren't going to see that this year. So I think that Banchero being good at being the best of the three out of the box is not a surprise. Him being legit good out of the box is, you know, room for optimism based on one game.
Yeah. My bonus corollary to the rookie of the year, my, by the way, facetious rookie of the year race question. Is it too soon to say, also slightly facetious, folks, is it too soon to say that the Knicks blew it by trading the pick that became Jalen Duren, who they actually could have had twice because they traded out of 11 and then they ended up with the 13th pick eventually and routed that to the Pistons to dump Kemba Walker's contract?
I mean, they out of that, they ended up with Jalen Brunson and Isaiah Harden seems pretty good. So, yeah. I mean, I think I don't know how much where that the Jalen Brunson signing ultimately gets them in terms of in the East pecking order. But that's, I mean, I think Jalen Brunson is going to be a better player for the next 2 to 3 years than Jalen Duren.
Yeah. I only brought it up because the Knicks have had so many of these moments where, you know, sliding doors and trading out of picks and or missing a guy or not, you know, taking Toppin over Halliburton, which I know a lot of my friends who are Knicks fans are still stung over. But also just because, listen, I'm on record as saying I thought clearing the room to get Jalen Brunson was the right move. They've needed a point guard since forever. I've been in this city for 18 years, and they've very, very rarely had anybody, and they've been short-term stopgaps for that matter, who could handle it. And I believe that having somebody as solid as Brunson, while he may never make an all-star team, just having somebody to settle things down, get people in the right spots, control the offense, make it easier on everybody so that, to our earlier conversation, a guy like Barrett's not having to overdo it, right? And it should hopefully get easier shots because of Brunson being there and them having some semblance of an offensive fulcrum.
I have to say, like, not to make everything about like transactions and contracts, but I feel a little different about the moves to get Jalen Brunson. I was sort of pricing in, well, and then RJ Barrett's going to get a max extension and blah blah blah, and he actually got a very reasonable from a team perspective extension. And so from a future like ability to continue to add talent. It's not the Brunson contract is not as much of kind of a salary cap brick as it might have been if they had already had, you know, all the like, you know, max money going out for RJ Barrett. And then whatever they end up doing with, you know, with Quickly and if they keep Toppin and then Quentin Grimes is going to end. So all these things. So I think that makes me revise sort of how I felt about that signing a little bit.
Yeah. All right. I had one other one, but I want to flip this around and let you go because I did ask you in advance. Give me a few things that have been kind of percolating. So give me two or three things, depending on timing here and when you need to jump. Give me something worth noting based on the first couple nights. That, again, small sample size, but given what we saw in the preseason, given what we already knew about a team or a player, some things that are worth noting now through small sample size theater that may or may not mean a thing when we get to April.
So there's three players that kind of run together, and one of them I expected it to be a problem, one I expected it to work it out, and one I wasn't sure, and it kind of didn't quite work out that way. I'm talking about, you know, the three prime most ball-dominant players in the NBA, which are Luka Doncic, James Harden, Trae Young. Now, I kind of expected, to their detriment, because of losing Brunson and not really adding any more create like on ball creation or ball handling, that like, that was going to steer even further into, you know, Luka does everything offensively, and he's coming into the season in better shape because of his summer national team play and stuff like that. That's fine. It's still the load on him has been too much, and in game one he already led the league, I believe, in as a stat I like to use called time of possession percentage, which is amount of time that the player has the ball relative to the time his team is on offense when he's in the game. He'd already been the league leader the last couple of years in that. And usually the league leaders are in the mid to high 40s. He's around 48% last year. He had the ball 54 some percent of the time he was on offense in game one. So that's, I expected them to lean into that more, and I don't think that's positive. I kind of expected Harden and Maxey to do a little more sharing, and it didn't work out that way. Harden's time of possession is up a little bit. And beyond that, there were a number of possessions. I think Steve Jones of the Dunker Spot podcast had a Twitter thread where he pointed out some of these. There are still these – if you're playing – part of the appeal of having like a two-guard front like this is you can play off each other. Tyrese Maxey can run effectively action on one side. And then the defense shifts, you kick the ball to the other side, and then James Harden can attack a shifting defense. They did the first part of that, but then the ball swings to Harden and he holds it. And, you know, if he's basically turning himself into a guy you don't have to guard on the perimeter if, like, Jason Tatum, who's guarding him for a lot of time, is helping way into the paint and has all the time in the world to close back out to him. And so the lack of synergy between what should be three very strong offensive options in Philly was concerning in game one. And then on the flip side, players who I did not think were as natural a skill set fit in Trey and DeJounte Murray, because DeJounte Murray has never really been a good off-ball player because of skill set, and Trey has never been an especially willing or active off-ball player. In game one, it actually worked pretty well. His time of possession percentage was down, you know, still in the 40s, but it was down from like 48 to 42. And after taking 77 catch-and-shoot threes all of last year, he took four on opening night. He didn't make any of them. But still, if Atlanta can balance the load of their offense better, I don't know how much it helps them in the regular season. But I think, and looking towards a postseason, I think it makes them a much more difficult and resilient offense to contend with if they can attack from multiple angles, if you have to account for Trey when he doesn't have the ball. Much like, you know, Doncic and Harden, he's been a guy who, when he gives the ball up, has kind of tended to, I'm going to stand by half court and wait till I get it back or take the rest of the play off. If you have to, well, actually, no, he's a great three-point shooter spotted up, so we still have to guard him. That I think, while someone competent with the ball is doing something on the other side of the floor, I think that just makes them so much more difficult to guard. Now, it's one game. We'll see if it lasts. But that if I was a Hawks fan or in the Hawks organization, that would be a very encouraging development to me.
You know, it's funny. On the Harden note, I thought, and I don't want to overreact, but we're doing overreaction theater and small sample size theater, so why not? If I'm going to overreact to a data point from the Sixers' first game, it's not even anything that Harden did, although there was plenty of that too. It's something he said, because Chris Haynes for Turner on the TNT broadcast said, I talked to James Harden today, and he said he's going to show everybody this season why he's still the old James Harden from Houston, why he can still play at that level. And I thought, okay, fine. Like, physically, that's a good thing for the Sixers and for James Harden. But then he went out and played a game in which it seemed like he was trying to remind us by dominating the ball whenever he got the chance. And I thought, well, that's not good. I mean, if you wanted to justify the way he played in Houston, you could say, well, the results justified it. You could say that the supporting cast justified it. You now have Joel freaking Embiid, the two-time runner-up for MVP, and Tyrese Maxey, who could be, you know, a perennial all-star eventually. This is not a time for James Harden to be playing like Houston James Harden. So I don't want to overread into what he told Chris Haynes, but when Chris came on and said that, and then Harden played to a different standard, it was like, I'm not just doing, then it makes me wonder, are you just doing this for the numbers and for you to raise your profile again and get the respect back that you think you lost? Like, if that's the case, you know, that could hurt them.
I don't even think you need to be, you know, that might be the way he thinks they can win basketball games. I don't agree with that. But I think that it's not outside the realm of possibility. I mean, it being James Harden, I think that probably leads us to believe certain things. There are a number of players who, you know, play a way that maybe is not the best way to play, but it's the way they think is best for the team. And so you don't even have to get like that with it. Just like, you've got Joel Embiid. Why are there four people standing and watching James Harden dribble the ball at the top of the floor every possession?
Yes. Yeah. Right. That to me is a problem. And one that, you know, Harden's got to find the balance, and Doc is going to have to get them to find the balance where, you know, Harden at his best is going to be as effective as he was in Houston, but not as ball dominant as he was in Houston. I think that should be the fair compromise.
And you're giving enough away defensively with the Harden Maxey backcourt that if they're not playing off each other, you're kind of losing that trade-off.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's like, if you have that backcourt, your offense has to be top three in the league. And they can be a top, I don't know, eight offense playing a certain way, but they need higher than that. And that means they need to have those three players interacting and you know, bouncing off each other and making each other better in ways that I don't totally think they did on opening night.
Seth, if you were to allow yourself, turn off your sophisticated analytical brain for a moment, and you allowed yourself to just believe in what you saw in these small sample sizes of these three teams, is there anything that, if you allowed yourself to do that, would change where you thought these teams might finish? Like, based on the small sample size of Trey and DeJounte actually working pretty well together and off of each other, do you think a little bit more positively about the Hawks? Do you think a little bit more negatively about the Sixers? Little more negatively about the Mavs, or is that maybe just kind of exactly where you thought they'd be?
I tend to be a little stubborn on these things. So while the Hawks would give me room for optimism, I still wonder about overall talent level relative to the top of the East. Are they, you know, I think that they're like maybe on Cleveland's level. I don't think they're on Boston, Milwaukee, Philly at their best level yet. And so I'm gonna have to see it for a little bit longer to get there. Dallas, I was short Dallas to start the year, for reasons we talked about, nothing that happened on opening night, even with Christian Wood having a very strong game, moved me off of that. And, you know, for Philly, you can't win the title in October. So like give it time, but it was not how uninvolved Tyrese Maxey was for much of that game was not the first installment I would have wanted to see.
You brought up Christian Wood. You know, the Mavericks, you know, they obviously lose Jalen Brunson, but okay, Tim Hardaway Jr. gets healthy, and now it's a full season of Spencer Dinwiddie, and if he stays healthy, and then you got Christian Wood and JaVale McGee, and so now you've, you know, the optimistic Mavericks fan would say, well, we've offset the loss of Brunson in a different way, right? Like, we lost the guard play and the playmaker, you know, creator, whatever, do stuff when Luka's not on the court. But we now have these dive threats we didn't have before, and Christian Wood could shoot the jumper too. And so we just got different. Like, is there a, could you buy into an optimistic view there? And as a part of that too, Christian Wood came in with, or at least got to Dallas with, the reputation of maybe being kind of a hollow big numbers guy. And I don't know, you know, what the analytics say in general about like guys who put up big numbers on losing teams, and whether there's an actual cause effect there, and whether those guys deserve that label. But did Christian Wood deserve that label? And is what he's doing in Dallas potentially a net positive, just in a different environment?
So I think that the good stats, bad teams, sometimes it goes either way. There are some players who, you know, they do help the team when they're on the floor, but it doesn't matter because there's not enough talent. He's been a player whose career has been sort of spotty enough in terms of his role and how much he's actually played that I wouldn't want to make any great pronouncements on that. But more pertinently, I don't actually think that Wood being the guy who ends up taking the shots actually reduces kind of the physical load on Luka all that much. He still has to create everything. And that's, this is when he was taking all the shots, it was more demonstrable. But there's been a history over his career, something I've looked at in the past, where if you look at games where he has to have huge, like 35% usage in the first half of games, his efficiency in the second half of games is much lower than games where he's been able to spread it around a little bit in the first half. And by losing Jalen Brunson, maybe he doesn't have usage in terms of taking all the shots, but he's still going to have the ball in his, like I said, he had the ball in his hands over half the time his team was on offense in game one. And that's that, you know, even if he's in the coming into the season in better shape, he is going to wear down, and they are going to lose close games, and they're going to get to the playoffs, and they're going to lose close games in the playoffs. And how many close games in the playoffs do you have to lose before it costs you a series? So I think, while there could be some positives to come from that, I don't think it really addresses what I perceive as the fatal flaw in Dallas's roster construction.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be curious to see as the season goes on whether they try to make a move to get another playmaker type, somebody else to share the load, at least take a little bit out of. Although, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie at his best, and I saw him at his best here in Brooklyn for a couple of years, I think can do some of that. But to the extent that the Mavs have felt very, very Luka heavy, and that I think that there's a ceiling on a team being that heliocentric, as you would say.
You were the first who first brought that idea to me, and I think I've largely come around to your viewpoint on it, that you really are, you're hitting a ceiling by having one guy have to do too much.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's always for me been more suspicion than provable fact, but I just always kind of felt that, yeah, if there's a logical limit because of how predictable it makes you, because of how much it wears down the guy who's doing it, whether that's Luka or Harden or Westbrook back in, you know, in his prime. There's an aesthetic side of this too, and the chemistry side of it, and other guys need to be involved side of it, but you know, that gets into like squishy, you know, chemistry stuff that's almost impossible to quantify. But
which team you like watching more isn't an irrelevant metric.
Not irrelevant. No. Yeah. No.
I hope it's true because I like watching this more.
Well, and it goes to the conversation we had on your podcast, which people should go check out, of course, which is that, like, we were talking about the Warriors. Like, the Warriors are just fun to watch. And a lot of it is just their basketball chemistry. Forget their off-court chemistry, whether or not there's other things to work out because of Draymond's punch of Jordan Poole. Their basketball chemistry is brilliant. They just dice teams up because they're constantly moving and reading each other and hitting each other in stride, and the ball doesn't stick hardly ever. That's more enjoyable to watch than one guy, however talented he may be, pounding the living shit out of the ball. And if that leads to more wins, even better. But
I think it was a pretty sharp contrast on opening night with Boston, in terms of Boston was, for the most part, and for an offense, the last time we saw it was not that, in the finals. Like, if the offensive like approach they had, now obviously you're talking about different defenders in with Golden State than you are with Philly. I think that Andrew Wiggins, for example, is a far better matchup for Jason Tatum than PJ Tucker is at this point in his career. But for everything you're describing about kind of the adage about the ball having energy and spreading that around and letting everyone have some fun, like the way Boston played on opening night was a sharp contrast, I thought, there's a joyfulness in playing that way that not only is more fun to watch, but I think it's probably on balance, all else being equal, more effective.
Yeah, I obviously agree, and it'll be interesting to see if that continues as well as we speak about small sample sizes. I know you got to get out of here. Any other quick thoughts? Any other stat or trend? Is one game trend a trend? Even probably is not.
It's not.
The copy editor would tell me no.
Yeah. I picked the Nuggets to make the finals preseason. And I think it's going to end up being a burn the tape game in game one, but that was not good in Utah last night. The telling stat from a team that has shooting, that has the best passer in the league, and probably one of the most players most able to draw defensive help in the league, is they only generated 8 open threes all night against a team whose best defensive player is Jared Vanderbilt, and whose second best defensive player is Mike Conley at 30 whatever years old. So I think that Denver will play a lot better. But just in terms of opening night, what happened? That's almost a bigger that's a bigger mystery to me than Brooklyn getting walloped, but what I think is going to be a pretty good New Orleans team.
Yeah. And there's another one while we're overreacting. Man, the Pelicans, whew, they looked amazing.
Zion took 17 shots at the rim.
Wow.
There will be teams that might not average 17 shots at the rim a game this season.
Yeah. He is, as we've just been reminded very vividly, very hard to stop once he's on the move. And he will chase his own misses and other people's misses, and he doesn't need much room, and he will find the room if it's not there. Just an amazing performance by him, and a lot of fun. Speaking of basketball is just being fun to watch. The Pelicans, wherever they end up this year, I think are just going to be a lot of fun to watch. So Good deal. Had a few other things that were potentially on the agenda, but we'll do it again and get to those the next time. Seth Partnow, thank you for coming on again. The book, again, The Mid-Range Theory, the podcast, which I was on, and you can go listen to us yammering there as well as Callin' Shots on the Callin' app, but also on Spotify and other podcast platforms. Seth, appreciate you, my man. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks a lot, Howard. Talk to you again soon.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Seth Partnow. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston, and thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.